start our Bible studies.
Yeah. Yeah. Start them in the best way.
I'm glad you weren't recording.
Yeah. All right. Starting in the intertestamental period today. And, okay, a couple of warnings. This is one of those kind of big head swimming, fire hydrant drinking kind of lessons. So, do your best to keep up. I tried to design your note-taking guide so that you weren't overwhelmed by information on the page, and you could just write things that stick out to you. Because what we're doing, we're covering history. A lot like when we cover church history, we're just going to be walking through the years and talking about what happened in and around Jerusalem. So it's going to be nations conquering one another and people and names and dates and stuff. Trying to give you hooks, things that you can say, okay. And grab onto that, and remember, this goes with that guy. All right, this is what he did, kind of. But we'll do our best. Forgot the other thing I was going to say. So, somebody want to give me a kind of a basic recap, briefly, of what the story of the Bible is so far. We've covered the whole Old Testament. Well done. You got the you got creation and the fall.
Searching for the seed.
Well, searching for the seed. Okay, and start searching through the seed in Genesis. Genesis 6. What happens?
Genesis 6 is the flood.
Flood, yeah. Flood, and then they get off the ark, and it tells them to scatter and multiply, and what do they do instead? They build a tower, and so then he scatters them, and then we find this one guy who God chooses, he's going to deal with him. Who's that?
Abraham.
Tells Abraham, what does he promise Abraham? Three things.
He promises to have
that his line will be large.
Land, seed, and blessing. His descendants would be like the sands of the shores of the sea. That's the seed.
And the stars. Bless him, curse
those who curse them, right? He promised them land. What land?
Euphrates to the Nile.
From the Euphrates to the Nile, and he promised them blessing. Bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's where we come in. The Messiah. Okay, so then Abraham has a son named
Isaac,
and then Isaac has a son named
Jacob.
Jacob's name gets changed to
Israel,
and Jacob / Israel has
Joseph,
12 sons. Yeah, the 12 tribes of Israel. And so from then on in the story, Exodus onward, we're looking at these 12 tribes of people, the nation of Israel. They spend 400 years in slavery in Egypt, and then they come out of Egypt because of a guy named
Moses.
Takes them to Mount Sinai, they get the law, they're developing their identity as a nation. They don't get to go into the land because they rebel, right? And then who takes them into the land, finally?
Joshua
comes along, takes them into the land, conquers it all. After Joshua dies, we've got the period of the...
Judges.
You guys are doing good. Cycles of Israel progressively falling away from God, constantly going against him, and him raising up a leader, a judge, to bring them back, telling them, walk with me, follow my statutes, and they rebel. And there's that cycle in the book of Judges. The end of the book of Judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and we hit, after the Judges, we see a story of a lady named Ruth. And... Yeah, well, nicely done. Ruth has Boaz, who has Jesse, who has David. Ruth has Boaz, who has Obed, who has Jesse, who has David. Nice. David is the second king of Israel. And that starts the period of the kings, right? And what's going on during the kings? First of all, how is the nation set up in the period of the kings?
It's split, right? Or has it not split yet?
Yeah, it's, so after Solomon, it splits.
Yeah.
Judah in the south and Israel in the north. Right, so we got two nations that we're looking at. 722 BC, Assyria comes along and annihilates Israel. What happens in 586 BC?
Babylonians
come in and take
them away, the exile.
Right, good, yeah. They take Judah away to exile. They spend 70 years in exile, and that's when Daniel is writing and Ezekiel. And that's when Esther happens. And then they come back. Who brings them back? They come back in three waves. Zerubbabel, and then two guys whose books of the name Bible are named after. Okay, yeah, those are the Persian kings. Cyrus is the king who says, yeah, you can come back.
Isn't it...
the two guys, Nathan?
Ezra and Nehemiah.
Oh, Ezra and Nehemiah.
Yeah. They bring him back into the land. So now they've gone through the exile. They've come back into the land. They've rebuilt the temple. They've rebuilt the city wall. And civilization starts again for the people of Israel. They're living under Persian rule at this time. And because while they're in exile, the nation shifts from Babylon to Persia. And we're going to look at that today. So the intertestamental period is kind of starts in the middle of the exile, skips over Ezra and Nehemiah, and then we move on. Intertestamental period just means period in between the testaments. This is how we're going to do this. Talk about intertestamental period in general, give you a brief overview of the history that we're going to cover. Basically, look at the major nations that are going to come in and take the land. Then we'll look at the biblical texts that tell us about this stuff. Mostly Daniel is the one prophesying all the stuff is going to happen. And then we're going to look at the history in detail. Hopefully it'll make sense. But to start out with, why bother studying the intertestamental period? Answer, because it answers a lot of questions. It answers questions like, how do we go from Persia at the end of the New Testament to all of a sudden Rome is in charge at the end of the Old Testament, and all of a sudden Rome is in charge in the New Testament, and they're speaking a different language, and there's these groups of people like Pharisees and Sadducees that Jesus is really all up in their face about, and Greek is the main language, and Jesus is speaking Aramaic, and there's this guy named Herod who's killing people. And all this stuff is like, okay, they just assume you know this when you start reading the New Testament. And none of this was in the Old Testament. The book ended in the Old Testament, and you're like, how did we get to here? You got to know your intertestamental period history to answer any of those questions. Intertestamental is a big, big scary word. It just means the period of time in between the testaments, old and new. Intertestamental period. Yeah, okay. Most of it is prophesied about in Daniel. Chapters 2, 7, 8, and 11 all carry prophecies about this period of time. And Daniel is writing at what period of time in Israel's history?
600 BC.
Captivity. The period when Israel was off in Babylonian captivity. That's when he's writing this. He's writing about history that happens after they come back, right? He's writing future history. We're going to look at most of these prophecies that he does. The intertestamental period spans from about 400-ish, 424, about when it starts, when the canon closes in the Old Testament, to Jesus' birth, 5 BC. The one thing to remember about the intertestamental period, there's always war going on somewhere. The whole point of all of this is characterized by one nation taking over another nation, and then that nation taking over or being falling to another nation, and then another nation coming in and taking them over, and it's just this constant land grab for the Middle East. And if you know the four nations that cycle through this land, it really helps you to keep your history straight and understand what's going on. So to that end, we're going to look at the four nations, kind of five. Let me take it over. So when they're off in Babylonian captivity, after Assyria's done, Babylon's in charge, they hold all this place, and you see this nation up here, what's it called?
The Median Empire.
Also it called the Medo-Persian Empire, Medes and Persians. Two nations that came together and said, we're going to form one nation now. And Babylon's down here, and they're holding all of this area. Okay. Daniel 2 talks about the statue. Daniel 9. Daniel 9 is the prophecy. There's a chapter in Daniel. Talks about the writing on the wall. Have you guys heard that story? What's that story kind of about?
Yeah,
What happens?
The There's hand
yeah.
goes and writes stuff, and the guy kind of freaks out and calls him. I guess he calls
Wasn't it because they were using the stuff for sacrificing?
Or?
The silver.
Yeah, was it because of what they were using to eat, right?
No, you're mixing up two of them. So Daniel, this is when Daniel's in his older years, and the king of Babylon is all feasting and rejoicing and living it up, and then he sees a hand start writing on the wall, right? Mene, mene, tekel, something else. I forget what the last one is. And Daniel comes in and he says, what you saw was a hand writing these things. It means that Babylon's about to be destroyed. And then that very night, the Persian Empire takes over Babylon. Cyrus the Great wipes out Belteshazzar. That's the succession. So in one night, Babylon turns into Persia. Cyrus snuck in, took the main city, the capital, and it was kind of like one of those seamless transition things. All of a sudden, Babylon is under Persian control. It is now Persia, the Persian Empire. And over about 100 years, Persia spreads out and takes over all this land. When you see this map, you know where on the world that is? I don't even want to take that for granted.
Across the ocean.
Like, what's down here?
Mediterranean.
Africa.
What's up here?
America. Something that's higher than
America.
Europe. Russia's over here, right? India's right there.
I'm just going to let y'all know that Stephen is right. It's not just him saying that. It's actually
okay. Thank you. Glad to have your support. So yeah, this is the Middle East. This is where all of your biblical history happens. It's good to know this area, at least a little bit in your mind. Where's Jerusalem?
Somewhere.
Right there.
It's right there.
We lost Jerusalem.
It's kind of like with Atlantis.
Jerusalem has fallen.
It helps you if you know where on the earth it is. It's not just some fairy tale land or like some made up map like in the Lord of the Rings of Middle
that
Earth.
That is it, so real.
This is an actual place that you can fly to and walk on in real life. So Persia is ruling for about 100 years, and there's a succession of kings in Persia we're going to talk about. Cyrus the Great, then Cambyses, Gautama, Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, and you know some of these characters from the Bible, by the way. We talked about a couple of them two weeks ago with Clint, 3 weeks ago?
It was
2 weeks
ago.
2 weeks ago with Darius and Cyrus and Xerxes were all involved in Ezra and Nehemiah coming back. So it's during this time that they're coming out of exile, they're going back to Jerusalem, they're rebuilding the temple. Then a guy named Alexander the Great comes along, and he's got a big beef with Persia because the Persians fought his dad. And so he says, I don't like Persia, I'm going to go destroy them all. And he just marches down from Macedonia, and he just takes the Persians out one battle at a time and controls all of them and starts the Grecian Empire and conquers the known world, as it's usually put. You know the line from Die Hard, right? And Alexander looked at the breadth of his domain and wept for there were no more worlds to conquer. That's from something else before Die Hard, but that's how I know it. But then, tragically, Alexander dies early in his life at 32, I think. It took him like 3 or 4 years to conquer all of this. And then he dies, and his empire gets split into four. There's four leading generals. He didn't tell them what to do with his empire, so they split it among the four of them. Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And they split the empire into these four different areas. And notice the year about 300 BC.
Where was Alexander from? Sorry, it's like zoned out.
Alexander was from Macedonia.
Okay.
Greece. Modern-day Greece. Really, modern-day Macedon, but Greece. So then they split his empire up. So there's four little empires. And those empires just war with each other, gradually decay into disarray, giving way to Rome to come along 200 years later and take over everything. Rome really starts to take over most of this area in the 100s, 1 to 200s BC. And by 180, they own everything in the world. Rome was a massive empire. That's your brief flyby overview kind of thing. We're going to get down in the weeds in a little bit. But first, we're going to look at the biblical texts that explain this history, that literally predict all of these things happening pretty specifically. And then we're going to look at how they happened exactly like the Bible said. Crazy. So the text. There's extra-biblical texts. That means texts that are outside of the Bible that tell us about this history. And then there's biblical texts. Anybody... The basics, how do you study history? Anybody
you go
know?
And buy a history book?
Yeah, okay, yeah. You read it. You read about it. How is history done?
You try really hard to memorize
that. That's not the right way to do it. Yeah. You can't scientifically prove history, right? The Battle of Gettysburg can't be proven scientifically. It's proven historically. What we do is we look at what was left over, and we look at first-hand accounts. We look at archaeology. We find like a little arrowhead somewhere, and we say, oh, okay, this wasn't natural. Somebody made this. There must have been somebody who lived here at some point who made this arrowhead. What do we think they used it for? Oh, well, it's sharp. Okay, they probably... used it for cutting. Oh, maybe they used it on arrows. Okay, we found other ones. And look, this one's attached to a stick. Okay, it looks like it's actually... That's how history's done. You look at the evidence and you gradually put together a picture. And you look at first-hand accounts. That's always your best source of history. You talk to the people who were there. So, first-hand accounts of history, there's lots of Roman historians who recorded the history of Persia and Rome and Greece, because they were paid to do it. And not all of them are 100% accurate. There are plenty of times when we can see, okay, clearly the culture or his personal beliefs were affecting what he recorded here. There's a guy named Josephus. He's a big historian for Christians and Jews. He wrote down a lot of things that the Jews did, in particular Antiquities and the Wars of the Jews are the two books that I drew from to get this information. He was a turncoat Jew. When Rome was annihilating the Jews in 70 AD, he surrendered and said, wait, don't kill me. I speak a couple different languages. I can be your scribe, your historian. So they took him on. He was a traitor to the Jewish people, joined Rome so that he could record history.
And not die.
First and Second Maccabees are two books that the Roman Catholics affirm as scripture, but we don't. But they record some of the history that happens in between this time. So they're good historical documents to look at.
So
they're
why
not inspired.
Aren't they in the, like, why don't you, or, I don't know how to phrase it.
Why don't we consider them biblical texts?
Yeah, I guess.
Two reasons. One, the early church councils didn't choose them as part of the biblical texts, mainly because they were written in Greek. They were pre-Christ documents written in Greek, and so they didn't count.
Okay.
If you want a pre-Christ document, it had to be written in Hebrew. That was the language of Scripture. That's why the Jews didn't consider it inspired biblical texts. And so the church fathers kind of agreed with that line of thinking.
Okay.
I would say, more simply, we don't consider them inspired because they're not. There's notable errors or things that you would say don't line up with the rest of the biblical texts that we do affirm. And so, obviously, they can't be inspired and inerrant if they disagree. That's the short answer. But go back and listen to the church history thing when we covered the canon. And we talked about the Apocrypha a lot. So, First and Second Maccabees are part of the Apocrypha. So, anytime we talked about that, that was... The biblical text that covered this, some of this history, is most of Daniel. So we're going to look at some of these. This is that the handwriting on the wall thing. It says, Mene, Mene, Hagral, know how calm. Anyway. Tekel. Oh, that's a T. Top. I'm sorry. I'm practicing my Hebrew. What's funny is Rembrandt didn't know Hebrew. He had somebody else tell him, and so he wrote it vertically, and he didn't realize he was writing it vertically. He thought that that's how Hebrew was... Or he didn't realize that it wasn't supposed to be written vertically. He thought that's how Hebrew was written. So people who read Hebrew, they're like, why is he writing up... anyway. First biblical text that covers some of this history is the dream of the statue. You guys might know this story. Daniel chapter 2. You want to get your Bibles out and go to Daniel, because we'll be in there most of the day. Nebuchadnezzar, he's the king at the time. Daniel and his three friends are young men. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And he wakes up and he is terrified because he cannot remember the dream. And so he tells all of his wise men, tell me what the dream was and what it means or I'm going to kill you.
But he couldn't remember?
He couldn't remember.
That would have been the worst.
And his people, his advisors are like, well, we can't tell you what it means unless you tell it what it was. And he's like, well, why should I trust your interpretation if you can't tell me what it was?
I thought he did that... I might be mixing up with a different dream time because there's multiple, but I thought he said that they had to tell him so he knew they were the real deal.
Yeah, that's...
Wait, was it like, with he knew what the dream was, but they had to tell him what the dream was and then interpret it so he would know.
I might be
okay.
Adjusting it in my mind.
I know that happens at least once.
The cows eating the cows.
Pharaoh.
Yeah, that's Pharaoh.
That was with Joseph.
Yeah, I was like...
Okay, that's the one because they had to tell him the really weird one about that.
But he did the whole the same thing, right?
We can read it and find out. So, let's do that. We can clear this up right now. Daniel chapter 2. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dream. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans and the king of the Aramaic said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever, tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time, saying to the king, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. The king answered, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time changes. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. So yeah, you could probably read it either way. The phrase, make the dream known to me, is what leads some people to think, okay, he doesn't know the dream. But it makes total sense the way you were talking to Zach. So they go and get Daniel. Daniel's like, give us one more day and we'll tell you what it was. And he comes along and Daniel tells him what the dream was. And this is what the dream was. Verse 31 of chapter 2. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image is mighty. This image is mighty, of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of the image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet part iron and part clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on the feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. And the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold all together were broken in pieces and came like a chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell you the king its interpretation. O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of fields, the birds of the heaven, rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So the dream was he saw this statue, and then a rock came in and crashed into the feet and disintegrated, flew away. He says, O king, king of Babylon, you are the head of gold. lost my place. Verse 39. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. You shall have feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. It shall be a divided kingdom of some firmness, and we get into all crazy kinds of interpretations with that, so we'll leave that for now. But the basic outline is each different section is a different empire. We look at the history, we know this to be true, right? History we just walked over. Babylon fell to the Medo-Persians. Medo-Persians fell to Alexander the Great in Greece. Greece fell to Rome. Daniel gets promoted, and Nebuchadnezzar's all awesome. And then they have the fiery furnace debacle. And it takes a little while. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar gets converted. He sees the light. Takes him being cast out from his nation and eating grass in the field like an animal. But finally, he gets it. He starts worshiping the true God. Let's jump to chapter 7. This is a different vision. So, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, so he tells you when he is. This is a little bit later. Still, none of this stuff has happened yet. Persia hasn't taken over the empire yet. Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel saw a dream and visions in his head as he lay in his bed. He wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. So in this dream, he has a vision of four different beasts. They show up. One looks like a lion, one looks like a bear, one looks like a leopard with four heads and four wings, and one looks like a terrible beast, and he doesn't recognize. So we're going to read it real quick. Verse 2. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirred up with a great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. And I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground, and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of the man was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second one, like a bear, it was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth, and it was told, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful, exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with his feet. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in the horn were eyes, the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him, and thousands, thousands served him. And 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. All right. Talking in time stuff there at the end. Again, the second half of that dream, we need a whole other class to talk about it. But the first half, the four basic beasts, are pretty easy to interpret. You got a lion with wings. He stands up like a man. You got a bear who's lopsided. You've got a leopard with 4 heads and 4 wings, and then a terrible beast. Lots of people think it was a dragon. We didn't know what a dragon looked like.
I think that's just mean. Not all dragons were mean. I feel like... I think that's species.
It's speciesism, yeah. It's at its worst. Daniel's just a dirty speciist. And then, you know, the Holy Spirit inspiring him to write those things, too.
Well, he says beast, but everybody who draws pictures of him assume it's a dinosaur.
I'm going to show you 2 things that I found 2 that don't fall in that vein. I like them. But. So the first one, which nation is that?
Babylon.
He stands up like a man. Lots of people think that that's Nebuchadnezzar, you know, going through his conversion, standing up. He was a beast, but he becomes a man. Second nation, what was that?
Lopsided bear.
Lopsided bear. Medo-Persia.
Why Medo? What's that mean?
Medes and the Persians. So there were kind of 2 people that unified and created 1 nation, but the Persians were like the dominant force in this relationship, which is why the bear's lopsided. Persia's bigger, and eventually it kind of devoured the Medes, and it turned into just Persia. Leopard. Which nation is the leopard? Greece.
Guys,
it's Greece. Thank you.
I saw Rome at the bottom.
Here's a question. Why does it have four heads and four wings?
The four, didn't they divide it into four?
Greece divided into four nations, right? Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy.
Totally.
You knew those right off the top of your head.
Yeah, you did.
And then you had a terrible beast with 10 horns.
Well, it looks like Rome. Evil version of Groot.
There are two. That one. I like that one because that's the horn that sprouts up. Three of them are cut off and one comes with it. But both of those are terrible beasts that are not dragons.
That horn looks like the sword attack from Harry Potter.
Yes.
It kind of looks like what's his name from Spider-Man?
I think it looks beastly. So
okay, so Daniel is having these dreams and these visions during the time of Babylon, during the king of Belshazzar, and writing down what occurred with remarkable accuracy. So remember, we went over the history. Is that pretty much what happened? Yes is the answer to that obvious yes or no question. That's Daniel 7. So this is two dreams that really tell you the exact same period of time. So the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has about the statue, talking about the exact same things that this vision that Daniel has about the four beasts.
Wait,
Daniel
so
2, Daniel 7.
If they were, or what?
No.
Five sections on the, in Daniel 2, why are there, oh, wait. Yeah, why
there's always this, so there's the feet of part iron and part clay, and then with the extra beast, there's all this stuff talking about the little horn cutting off three horns and speaking and
speaking
great
like
words.
The last one, is it combined?
So yeah, the last one is like, there's a lot of interpretation and a lot of work in doing it, so we're not really worrying about that right now.
Okay.
That's another topic for another time. But the four basic sections are good for you to get. There's another section, Daniel 8. So chapter 8 is another vision that Daniel has. And this one's in the third year of King Belshazzar. So a year after he has this vision, he has this vision. This vision, he sees two animals. There's only two. There's a goat and a ram. And they're fighting. And the goat kills the ram. And then the goat's horn gets cut off and four horns take its place. Can you kind of guess, see where this is going? Where are you going to see?
The four generals.
Yeah. So this is the vision that Daniel has in chapter 8. In the third year, the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is the province of Elam. Don't worry about that. He's telling you where he is. And I saw in the vision, I was at Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the banks of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him. There was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the banks of the canal, and he ran at him with powerful wrath.
He would have been a unicorn.
I saw him come close to the ram. And he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the... I'm not going to worry about that part. We'll skip down. What's great about this particular vision is an angel shows up and tells him exactly what it means. Word for word. So we're going to jump down to there where the interpretation starts. Verse 18, if you're reading along, which I encourage you to do. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand up. He said, Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. As for the horn that was broken in his place, of which four other horns arose, four kingdoms shall rise from his nation, but not with his power.
What?
And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king from the bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fear, destruction, and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and people who are the saints. Talks about this other king. Again, there's debate as to which king this is. So what happens?
Whoa.
There's a ram. There's a goat. The goat kills the ram. He tells you the names of the nations. Remember when he's receiving this vision? Back in the days of Babylon, before Persia even exists. Right? He tells you there's going to be this nation called Persia. It's going to be great. It's going to trample over everything it touches. And it'll be the Medes and Persians. And then Greece is going to come along. And the first king of Greece is going to be great and powerful. He's going to trample over the Persians. That's exactly what happened. Alexander the Great comes in, annihilates Persia. And then it's going to split into four.
Did you do that yourself, Stephen?
No. Well, I mean, I found those two pictures online and then lined them up so that only that changes.
What a magic trick. A PowerPoint, Josh.
No, I mean, like, did he edit the horns on himself?
So for all of the visions, they knew exactly what they meant.
Really, Daniel did.
Okay.
If you want more,
so far.
I have, like, five packets in my room when I thought on that.
I didn't
miss
so.
It. Yeah,
I miss
you.
I think it was Dr. fault that I missed it.
Daniel 11 is the last vision that addresses this thing. Daniel 11 is a lot more confusing. So, be forewarned, Daniel 11 is a lot harder to interpret. It doesn't just tell you, you know, names and dates kind of thing. Granted, he didn't give dates, but... Daniel 11, verse 1, Gabriel's talking. As for me and the first king, year of Darius the Mede, I stood up, confirmed, and strengthened him. Now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. So Darius is a Persian king. So we're fast-forwarding in time to when he receives this revelation. It's already in the time of Persia. Three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth that shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. And a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven. What's he talking about?
Is it Persia being taken over?
Yes, by
Greece, Alexander the Great. As soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken off and divided toward the four winds of heaven. Right when Alexander the Great was done conquering, he died, and his nation was divided into four pieces. Nor according to the authority with which he ruled. Verse 5, and the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he, and shall rule, and his authority shall be great in authority. We're going to hold off on this until we get to that period of the history as we're walking through, because it'll make more sense if you see the history first. And then. But basically, he's talking about Alexander the Great, his nation being divided into four, and then the kings of the south is Ptolemy, and the kings of the north is the Seleucids. And they go on fighting back and forth. There's five major wars that go on between them. And eventually the Jews set up shop and Hasmonean period. We'll get to that. So keep Daniel 11 in the back of your mind. You guys understand the other three visions though, right? Pretty clear? You got the statue telling about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And you got the four beasts telling about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And you got the he-goat and the ram. And what two nations are those ones talking about?
Medo-Persia and Greece.
Medo-Persia and Greece. Good. Those are the biblical texts. Lots of people doubt Daniel's authenticity because of how detailed and specific and correct his visions were. There are liberal scholars out there who'll be like, oh yeah, Daniel couldn't have written this so far in advance. We deny the supernatural revelation of prophecy, so he must have been recording it after it happened. And us conservatives are like, well, no, God told him what was going to happen because he's God. He knew.
Because he's God.
But Daniel dies.
It's kind of like the whole Batman.
The prophecy was finished.
Correct.
The whole what? So,
was that meant?
Josh. Which is why they say Daniel didn't write it. The guy says he's Daniel, he's lying.
Oh.
Again, liberal scholars. They don't care about what the text actually says. But. So now we're going to start getting into the weeds a little bit. Just where you might get a little bit lost, but we're going to try and keep you up to date. Start with the Persian Empire. All right? So we're back in...
Wait, what's that a picture on the right?
I'll tell you in a second. Oh. We're back in the time when Israel is living in the Persian Empire in exile, and they haven't gotten to go back to Israel. Cyrus the Great, the first Persian king after he defeats Babylon, says, you can go back. We talked about that with Clint. He gives them the edict that says that they can return. This is the Cyrus Cylinder. It's a very major archaeological discovery. Let me tell you what it's about. It's an archaeological discovery that was written by King Cyrus, that guy, in that time. It basically just is kind of a recording of that proclamation that the Bible records of where Israel was allowed to go back, but it's not that specific. It records talking about the general philosophy of Persia, freedom of religion, and freedom from slavery, and proclaiming the good news of Persia's rule, establishing an empire that everyone could live in peacefully. Persia's philosophy was, we're going to let people worship their own gods and have their own cultures because if they're happy, they won't rebel against us. So as long as you keep paying your taxes, we're good here. You can be part of the Persian Empire, no harm, no foul. You stop paying your taxes, we're going to come and kill you. That's how Persia did things.
So did they read up and down? Because those little marks, which I assume are words and not weathering...
Correct, yes, those are words. And I turned this picture, and when you read it, it's supposed to be
horizontal.
Yeah, that's... I think that's Akkadian. It looks like Akkadian.
Toilet paper roll.
The cylinder's about this big.
Yeah.
That's one big toilet?
Then you got Darius. So in between Darius and Cyrus, there was Cambyses, who was Cyrus's son, and Gautama. And Gautama was kind of like an imposter guy. He tried to take the throne. There's a little bit of internal turmoil in Persia. Darius kind of rises up and stamps it out, and reestablishes order in Persia. Darius is Darius the Great. He's the one who, Darius the Mede. He's the one who threw Daniel in the lion's den. So, give you an idea of when this history is happening. Darius is a pretty cool king. He's the one who unifies Persia, gives them coins, builds roads. He really steps up his game in terms of making Persia a functioning empire, like we think of in terms of society today. Xerxes came along after Darius the First. His other name that you might know him by is Ahasuerus.
I've never heard of
Yeah, never heard it before.
If you've read the Book of Esther, you've heard this name. It's,
I've probably heard it before. Just
it's Esther's husband. He's the one who, you know, the whole thing with.
Oh
yeah, I did have pictures with it. That is Daniel the Lion's. That's Ahasuerus.
Yes.
AKA Xerxes.
Oh yeah,
because
she marries the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Married...
Remember? You've seen this, right?
Yes. That's like the only thing I've actually. That's how I know about Megas.
Artaxerxes. Xerxes' son takes over. He's the one who sends Nehemiah back to build the wall. Nehemiah is Artaxerxes' cupbearer. Yeah. When you learn from Nehemiah last 2 weeks ago, and you're like, I'm going to go read the Book of Nehemiah now, which I really hope you did. But I nothing happened. Darius III is the last major king of Persia. he is in charge as Alexander the Great is coming along, wrecking shop, and he's the one who does a lot of battles with Alexander the Great, ultimately falls to AVG. And that's the end of Persia. The Greek history. So after Persia falls, Alexander the Great's in charge. There's a whole lot of battles and things I could tell you about. You guys want to know about all the kinds of stuff that Alexander the Great did?
Yeah.
You just want Stephen's highlights, or you want like more of the detailed? Tell me what you're thinking.
Both. Details are cool.
At the same time.
No, at the same time. I told you guys about that, right?
We know, Jonathan. You've said that at least
space
four
cadets.
Times.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Everybody is space cadets.
So Alexander the Great comes along. His dad, Philip, king of Macedonia, has a beef with Persia. And Alexander the Great's like, I don't like Persia. I'm going to go kill them all. Take over the nation. He discovers this great military strategy. Anybody know the incredible military strategy that Alexander the Great came up with?
Burn it all with fire.
That would be the
what?
Russians.
You looked like you were mimicking it. So. No?
Was it like the...
It's called the phalanx system. Have you ever heard of the phalanx system?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I learned about
what's the phalanx system?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm here.
So, he'd have all of his armies come into this tight... He'd find highways, roads to walk along. They'd walk in these tight formations and lines, and all of them would have spears. And they'd all have a shield. And so the front line would walk with their spears down in the front, and the rest of them would put their shields over the top and hold their shields, or hold their spears. And if somebody in the front line died, the next person would step up, put his spear down. So basically you got this walking, impenetrable mass of men, and you can't get close enough to them because they're holding an 8-foot spear. And their spears were about as far as me from me to Joshua. That's how long your spears are. So he had this method where he could just march through a city and just annihilate armies that were coming across it because they couldn't beat his phalanx system.
Kind of
so,
like 300 or less. Though.
Yes.
Well, the Roman turtle system was based off of that because he came before the Romans. So it's basically...
Oh, no, Nathan said it's like 300. No, I was just saying.
So he's just going through annihilating Persia one battle at a time. Fun little tidbit, when Alexander the Great gets down to Jerusalem and he's about to take the temple, the high priest pulls out the book of Daniel and he shows him Daniel chapter 8, and Alexander the Great says, oh, this is about me. And the priest is like, yeah. And he goes, okay, I'll leave you to your thing. And he leaves and he doesn't destroy Jerusalem or the temple. I think that's a wonderful story of the provision of God for the people of Israel. But,
he was a great guy, you know? He's a good guy. He was just so great.
He
was in the great.
He,
For sure, he's a Christian.
Definitely.
Eventually, Darius comes up with a way of fighting back a little bit. What he tells his people and his army is, go impale yourself on the phalanx spears.
Oh, wow.
Tells all of his underlings. He's really cheap. He tells all of the lowest of the low, go impale yourself on the spears. And, I mean, they have to do it because there's guys standing with swords on their backs, spears over there. I'm going to get impaled one way or another. So they go and they impale themselves on the spears, and what that does is it keeps them from being able to turn. Keeps them from being able to maneuver, because if you got 150, 200-pound man on the end of your spear, you're nowhere near as mobile as you are without 150, 200-pound man on the end of your spear. Basically, it makes it enough to where Persia can break through the phalanx, and that's the one almost success he has, but he has to flee because that kind of ended in a draw. Alexander the Great hunts him down.
Dead, but, you know, we beat him.
Darius runs away, and he offers Alexander the Great all of Asia Minor. He says, you can have this half of my empire. And there's a famous line that Alexander the Great, the messenger says to him, if I were you, Alexander, I would take it. And Alexander responds to him, if I were you, Hephaestion, I would take it. As in, like, if I were you, as in some weak-willed,
no.
If I were you, I would take it, but I'm not you. I'm going to just go through and destroy all of Persia and take it for myself. That's the that pretty sense. Clever. Alexander was quick on his feet. Anybody know who Alexander's tutor was?
No,
it was either.
It was
Merlin.
Stanley.
It's a philosopher scholar.
It was
yeah.
Merlin.
It was Merlin. Yeah.
It was either Plato or
Aristotle. It's Aristotle. Yeah. Socrates tutored Plato. Plato tutored Aristotle. Aristotle tutored Alexander the Great. It's how all of your history is linking together. It's great. It's wonderful. No.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Alexander the Great and Arthur are the same person.
Yeah, that's
it's
not
the sword and the stone. It was
sword
and about
the stone.
A thousand
the
years apart.
And the people.
Yeah. The 250 pounds.
They just kind of stacked them all up and stuck a spear in all of them. You know.
Basically.
It wasn't a matter of strength, it was just who could stand the smell of it.
After he defeats Darius III and Gaugamela, that's the last vestige of resistance he has. He takes over the rest of the Persian Empire, and he dies suddenly. Some people think of
poison.
Some people think it was dysentery. I think there's other proposed... illnesses that it was. It was some kind of illness, most likely.
Was he poisoned?
I don't think so.
What did you think it was?
I think it was...
Dead guy killed Paul McCartney.
And did the 9/11 attacks.
Anyway, he dies suddenly. So suddenly, he's just conquered all of Persia. He's established his own culture in all of Persia. He's turned Persia into Greece. It's called... Anybody know the word for it? With this process of what with changing the culture?
Hellenization.
Yeah. Hellenization. He Hellenizes the culture. Like Helen from Troy, right?
Got it.
That's why it's called Hellenization. But basically, he's taking the culture of Persia and making it the culture of Greece. What he does is he conquers areas, and then he'll say, okay, I'm going to take you and displace you from your land, scatter you amongst all the rest of my people, and you'll take on our language, you'll take on our customs, keep you from localizing and building up an uprising. Can't revolt as easily when you don't know anybody around you and you don't have a common ancestral threat. That's the process of Hellenization. So he did that a little bit to the Jews. Some of the Jews were Hellenized, the ones who were living in Egypt rebelliously. He conquers Egypt and the Jews who are there become Hellenized. The ones who were in Jerusalem stayed, Jewish Jews. They kept speaking Hebrew. And we're going to see that build tension over the next couple hundred years. But you got the Hellenized Jews who are Jewish by birth, but they've taken on Greek customs and cultures, and the Jews who are like, we're the pure Jews. We haven't succumbed to the Greek way of thinking and the Greek way of life. And there's going to be that kind of tension. But this is what Alexander does. He conquers the whole world, basically. Hellenizes it. Turns it into Greece. And then he dies. And his four biggest generals are like, well, we're going to take his empire, divide it amongst ourselves. So Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus divide
Seleucus
the empire.
Why does Seleucus get so much land?
Because it's kind of desertous. Yeah, it looks a little bit lopsided when you look at it on a map, but when you think about the geography of that area, let me get all the way back to that map.
Sorry.
Okay. I guess I could just jump to it if I were thinking.
If you wanted to do things the easy way.
You want to do it the easy way or the fun way? All of this is desert.
All right, yeah.
So there's not a whole lot here. You got the Fertile Crescent with the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, and then over here is not a whole lot of worthwhile land, except to get you to India. There's society in India, so there's like a couple roads running through this area.
Wait, so why is the red over on the far right? Why is there just a little part that's not yellow?
That's showing you the extent of where Alexander conquered. And then after he died,
so they lost
some of the land. Obviously, these two are over in Europe where there's a lot of society going on. The different Greek and Roman empires are building at this time. And then Ptolemy gets Egypt. So the two people that we're going to be looking at mostly are Ptolemy and Seleucus. They're the ones who are fighting because, remember where Jerusalem is? Right here. Notice what else is nearby. The line between where their lands stop. So Ptolemy and Seleucus are fighting, trying to gain land from each other. Their nations are. And Jerusalem is stuck in the middle. Get caught in the crossfires. Jump back to... Here. This goes on. There's five wars that go on during this time. Ptolemaic era and the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are the two people groups who are warring. And Ptolemy conquers a large portion for quite a period of time, up to about 190 BC. And he's the one who, when he conquers all that land, takes over Jerusalem. So we're all part of, like, connected to Egypt. He's the one who says, we need to translate the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. So King Ptolemy is the one responsible for commissioning the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, because he's sitting here going, look, everybody speaks Greek, nobody knows your ancient Hebrew language anymore, we need to give the people the scriptures in their common tongue. He kind of followed the let them have their religion philosophy and they won't rebel kind of a thing. The Seleucids are fighting with the Ptolemies, constantly trying to gain land. Eventually this guy Antiochus Epiphanes the IV comes along. This is a bad dude. That's who this is. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. One of the worst enemies of the Jewish people known to history. He comes along and he tries to fight back against the Ptolemies, takes some of Egypt, but Rome shows up and says, no, you don't get this land. So he kind of retreats and he goes back and he decides that he's going to pillage the Jewish people, all of their riches, in order to fund his campaign against Rome. Yep.
You should add that Rome was made up of the land that the generals had, like, taken from each other. Like, one of the generals succeeded.
Yes.
In conquering each other.
Yeah, Rome is building at this time. They're off in Rome, Italy.
Which general?
Europe.
I don't quite remember.
You're so
Scipio.
Adamant about everybody remembering stuff.
Scipio is the general who confronts him. Let me get back up to where we are on my notes. So yeah, the Seleucids are defeated by Scipio in Rome, and Antiochus Epiphanes heads back to Jerusalem and pillages the Jewish riches to fund his campaign against Rome. In the process, he also decides that he is going to annihilate Jewish culture. He profanes the sacrificial system. He tears down the temple, puts up idols. He doesn't like these Jews and what they're doing in his nation, and so he does whatever he can to stop them. There's a recorded story in the Book of Maccabees about taking seven brothers and torturing them to death because they wouldn't eat pork. They didn't want to break the law, the Torah, and so he tortures them to death. This one guy finally has enough of it. Mattathias Maccabeus comes along in 166 BC. Antiochus sends some people over to Modin, the city that Mattathias is living in, and he tells them to slaughter a pig on the altar, offer an unclean animal on the altar of God. And Mattathias is trying to stop him. He doesn't like it. Eventually, he loses it. He goes up and he kills the guy who's doing it. And he kills the Greek guard who's standing there watching him. And thus starts the Maccabean Rebellion, the Maccabean Revolt. He's got four sons. Judas, Jonathan, Simon, and John. Hyrcanus. He and his sons start this revolt, basically saying, we're tired of Greece. We want our nation back. We need to retake Jerusalem, the holy city. We need to clean up the temple, get it back functioning the way it should. They're a priestly family. They go off into the wilderness and hide out in camps, kind of do guerrilla warfare kind of thing. They're taking down Greece one city at a time. Judas leads the revolt after Mattathias is gone. Judas dies and Jonathan takes over, and then Jonathan dies and then Simon takes over, and John Hyrcanus takes over for Simon. They reconquer pretty much all of the land of Judea, and I think I gave you a map of that. Maccabean Revolt right here. So it shows you who we're looking at and where they conquered, starting with Jonathan. So the Maccabean / Hasmonean dynasty is this period with this family. If you'd like to know more about this, you can read on my blog at Maccabean Revolt. There's a post 3 or 4 down. I thought it was good. I almost printed it up for you. I spent a while working on it. But basically, they set up shop and make themselves the priests and kings of Jerusalem. They're a priestly family, so they do have a legal ability to take on the role of the high priest. Simon is the first one to take on the role of both leader of the rebellion / king and the high priesthood. John Hyrcanus does the same. And they establish the Hashemian dynasty, establish a new Jewish culture. Say, we are the kings and the priests, and we're going to follow the Torah. There's a mix of good and bad here. They did have zealous, they wanted to follow the law of God and didn't want to be conquered and made to profane the word of God. But there's also a little bit of power grab, because power corrupts. And it's during this time that the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes are developing. You guys have probably heard of the Pharisees and Sadducees, right?
What?
Have you heard of the Essenes?
No, I actually don't know.
Okay. These are the three basic groups within Judaism in terms of the religious elite. So during this period, during the Hasmonean dynasty, and a little bit before it, these groups are forming as different kind of ways of interpreting the scriptures, ways of living under this Greek culture that is oppressing us. How do we deal with the state? How do we interpret the scriptures? And these two guys, Hillel and Shammai, are kind of the ringleaders of the Pharisees. The Pharisees are this all comes out of Josephus. Again, if you read my book on the read the post on the Maccabean War, it tells you where to look in for the description. But the Pharisees are what you think of as the conservatives. They're the ones who want to know the scripture and follow it to the letter, know every single word, and even make up extra rules to guard ourselves from the rules that are in there. Make sure that we are following the law, every single thing that we're supposed to do, all 613 commandments. We want to make sure that we're doing them. Because we've seen what happens when we don't do them. We get conquered by Babylon. We get conquered by Greece. The Antiochians come in and destroy us. And Hillel is the first of these guys, leader of the Sanhedrin, to kind of let you know what he thinks of the law and how to follow it. Let me get to my notes on these guys. Hillel is born in about 110 BC, dies in about 10 AD, supposedly. According to Jewish tradition, he mirrors the life of Moses, 40 years in Israel and 40 years studying the scriptures and then leading the Jews for 40 years. But regardless, he becomes the head of the Pharisees, president of the Sanhedrin, and he records the rabbinic tradition. He gives these rules of how do you interpret scripture, and he tells people what the scriptures mean, kind of like what a pastor or a preacher is supposed to do nowadays. He is responsible for one of the Talmuds. Give me a minute. He's responsible for the Babylonian Talmud. So, you guys know what the Talmud is? Where did I start? Okay. It's okay to say no when I ask questions like that. So you got the Old Testament, right? And you got the Jews who are living off in the Babylonian exile saying, how do we apply these scriptures without a temple? So much of this stuff is talking about temple life and how we're supposed to do the sacrificial system. So how do we live by these rules when we don't have the temple to live by them properly? And so rabbis are coming along saying, well, good question. Let's see, how can we apply this in our context? And they're making up rules of how to apply them in your context. Again, much like we do with the Bible today. We say, this is ancient literature, and we say, let's talk about how we can rightly apply this to our lives today. So they start writing down some of these rules, and the problem is that they get a little bit zealous in their rule writing. So the Talmud is the collection of rabbinic traditions and teachings of how to rightly interpret and apply the ancient scriptures. And there's two main Talmuds, the Babylonian from Babylon, go figure, and the Jerusalem from Jerusalem, go figure. Hillel is responsible for the Babylonian Talmud. Shammai is responsible for the Jerusalem Talmud. There are these two big groups of writings of rabbis that tell you a certain way to interpret the scriptures. There's also other things like the Midrash. Which again, it's commentaries on top of the commentaries on top of the commentaries of the text. That's what the Talmud and the Midrash are. Are you bored yet?
I find it fascinating.
So that's a yes from.
It doesn't mean I'm bored. It just means I haven't had enough sleep, which is all the time.
Basically, easy way to think of it is the Talmud is the fence that the Jews put up around the law to keep them from getting anywhere near it. It's the extra rules that they added so that they wouldn't break the rules that they really weren't supposed to break. And Hillel and Shammai are two of the rabbis in this time who are the leaders in interpreting the law. So, again, this applies in the New Testament when the rabbis and the Pharisees and the Sadducees are coming up asking Jesus how to interpret certain scriptures, they're asking him, do you take the school of Hillel or the school of Shammai? Because they disagreed on a whole lot of things. And Jesus is like, neither of them are right. I take the scriptures. That's... Yeah, you get into all that. That's a little bit in the weeds. So, Pharisees are the conservatives. Both of these guys are, or Hillel's a Pharisee, and Shammai, I don't know which one he was, so. I don't know if Hillel was a Pharisee. Pharisees, again, it's like they started out pretty good. They're trying to follow the law. They're trying to do diligently with their religion. They just get carried away. The Sadducees are the Jewish sellouts is what I would call them. They're the ones who are kind of in the pockets of Greece and Rome. They're going after the power, the seats of power. They're the ones who are kind of selling the high priesthood to the highest bidder. And they take very liberal views of scriptures. They say, well, we'll believe what Moses wrote, the first five books, but the rest are up for debate. Don't really need to believe in the resurrection. Don't really need to believe in angels and demons and all that nonsense. We'll just take the law of Moses. The Essenes are the ones who are like, we don't like what's going on with this, the Jews and the culture at all. We're going to separate. We're going to go live by ourselves in little communities, communes. Think of them like monks. They're the ones who, separatists. They're responsible, most likely, for the Dead Sea Scrolls. Has anybody ever heard of those? Dead Sea Scrolls? Anyone?
I've heard of them.
The Dead Sea Scrolls is a collection of copies of the ancient scriptures, and they're the oldest known copies in history. They're from about this time period. They were found off in a little... This is a picture of Qumran, the Essene community, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. I've been there. It's pretty cool. I didn't take this picture. I was standing right there for most of when I was there. But...
standing in the same spot the whole time.
Well, we walked there. We stood there for a long time, and we walked up over around here, and then stood over underneath this little tent thing. But, so over here, you can kind of see one of them. See that little dot on the side of the mountain?
You mean that red one?
That's one of the scrolls.
See that little
yes.
black cave in the side of the mountain?
Yeah.
It's a cave.
Wow.
I can tell you how they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is good stuff, guys. The Dead Sea Scrolls is the most important archaeological find of this century. So, basically, a Bedouin shepherd was out one day. His sheep runs into a cave in the side of this mountain, and he throws a rock into the cave to scare it out. And he hears something shatter inside. He goes, oh, what was that? He goes in, and he finds these old clay pots. He opens the pots, and he finds scrolls inside of them. And he takes the scrolls and does whatever he wants with them. Later, he's walking around in the marketplace with his new shoes, and an archaeologist looks and he realizes that there's writing on his shoes. And this Bedouin shepherd had made sandals out of these ancient Dead Sea Scrolls. And the archaeologist looks at it and he's like, that's ancient Hebrew. he's looking at it, and he's like, where did you get this? And the Bedouin shepherd takes him to the cave where he found these scrolls, and he finds some of the others. And that was how the greatest archaeological find of the century was made.
So which one were the shoes? Which one was the shoes?
I don't know.
But they excavated the heck out of this area, and they found all of these different caves where the people living in this community had hidden all of these scrolls that they were copying. And there's something like 12 or 15 caves with different pots and remains of ancient scrolls that have been very well preserved because they were inside those clay pots. And you can go and see the Dead Sea Scrolls now in Israel. The most important archaeological find. The importance of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that we can look at these copies of the ancient scriptures. Isaiah was found in its entirety. It's the most incredible scroll ever. It's just the whole book of Isaiah. You don't find that very often in your ancient fragments. You usually find little pieces this big with writing on it. And so you read the words. Isaiah was math. Anyway, they're reading these and they realize that the accuracy to the text that we have today is something like 98%, 99%. Again, unheard of in textual continuation. That little variance between a scroll that was copied by hand 2,000 years ago and the text that we have today, almost identical. And the variance that was there was insignificant. It's like it says the instead of a, kind of a...
Unless it's the best.
Yeah.
That's more like 40%.
The Message is a great commentary on the New Testament. It's just not a translation. That's funnier for seminary students. Okay. So anyway, this is going on during the Hashemian period, during the Hashemian dynasty, when the Maccabees are ruling and they're setting up their shop. Also during this time, Rome is gaining power. It's building up a head of steam, and it takes over Jerusalem. Pompey comes in and finally captures the Middle East, puts it under the Roman control. So the Hashemians are no more. Excuse me. He sets up Antipater over the area as kind of the proconsul of the area. Antipater is the father of Herod. Let me find my place in my notes. 63 BC is when he defeats the Hashemian dynasty, takes it, puts it under Roman control. So, Jerusalem has gone from being under Persian control to then being under Greek control to then being fought over by the Seleucids and the Ptolemies to then being under Hashemian control and now under Roman control. All of these different groups are what contribute to the massive cultural shifts and diversity that you see in the New Testament. Pompey sets up Antipater as the proconsul. Antipater appoints his son Herod as one of the two governors of the region. And Herod does a little bit of political finagling over the next 20, 30 years to get himself made king over Jerusalem. And that catches us up to about 40 BC. So, Rome takes over, puts Herod in charge of the area as governor, and as Rome is doing its thing with Julius Caesar becoming emperor, and then Caesar falling to Antony and Octavian. Octavian, also known as Augustus. Caesar Augustus, does that ring a bell for anybody? He's Caesar when a certain Christ child is born. If you look in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, 2, maybe it's in Luke that he mentions Caesar. Yeah, it is Luke. Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. Octavian.
Sorry.
that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor. Syria and all the world was registered, each to his own town, and Joseph also went up from Galilee to the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David. So now we're caught up. That's the history. Fun stuff, right?
Yeah.
So let's go back to that slide. Answer some of these questions. How do we go from Persia in charge to Rome? Tell me the succession.
We had Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great took over Persia.
Who then died.
Who then died.
Was split with these four general guys.
Ptolemies.
Who all fought over it. And then Rome.
Who all fought over it. When they're fighting over it, who sets up shop in between?
Ptolemies.
The Maccabees. Hashmoneans. Right? And then Rome comes in, takes out the Maccabees. Where do the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Zealots come from?
Interpretation of the law.
With an H and the S.
Hillel and Shammai, right. They're interpreting the law for us as when we're living off in the Babylonian exile, because we don't know how to do these laws without a temple. Why is Greek the main language now?
What's his name?
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great.
Hellenizes the culture.
Hellenizes the culture. He said Greek is going to be your national language. So that's why they're speaking Greek. They're speaking Aramaic because that's a holdover from when Persia was in charge. They speak Latin because that's Rome's language. So when Jesus dies and Pontius Pilate says, write a sign over his cross that says King of the Jews in Greek, Aramaic, and Latin, that's why.
So is like, when a new ruler comes, they have to learn a new language, or is it like...
Depending on the ruler, yeah. So sometimes the rulers will set up shop and say, well, we're going to import a whole bunch of people here who learn this different language, so if you want to keep doing business, you're going to have to learn it. And it's organic, too. It's like eventually people just start speaking this language instead of that language, kind of like how half of Texas speaks Spanish in addition to English now, because you get enough people who speak Spanish together, more people are going
to
learn it.
Yeah, like if you go and spend time in Mexico without knowing Spanish, you're eventually going to learn some just because you have to be forced.
Anyway, I thought this was very eye-opening when I first learned it. I hope you learn something a little bit.
Yes.
It helps you answer questions.
But can you, like, go and see the cave?
In Qumran? Yeah. Where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls? Yeah.
Can you go inside?
You can.
No.
I didn't, because we didn't spend enough time there. But they do tours of the caves.
Where? The lonely! It was lonely!
You said they do do.
They do do.
Oh, okay. There we go. Got it. I was like, that's grammatically correct. Oh. Eschatological reference. Got it.
See, now I thought you were about to be saying they do do.
Yes.
Yes.
So would you put a comma? Or just like...
Just put them into.
They don't have no.
Poop is natural.
As in, they do. The first do is an affirmation. As in, yes. And then do, the second do is a verb. They.
My toe.
They execute. They do.
They do this. It's a they do this. Or yes.
They do do this.
Grammar.
That's all. If, like I said, the paper I wrote on the Maccabean Revolt actually does summarize the Maccabean history real well.
No, not that one. But yeah, it is that one.
And Jonathan has packets.